cabin.
Every Christmas
tape two.
Lost track of it. The grandchildren are coming up so fast.
Well, you got great grandchildren too.
Yeah, I have quite a bunch of them. That...
Well, maybe we could talk a little bit about what it's like for a person to be blind. You know, in the United States, there's a lot of people like that.
Yeah.
And but a lot of people don't understand what it's like. And so maybe you could say something about what it's like for you.
Well, I tell you, a lot of times I wish I could see again. A lot of times I get someplace and I'm lost, or just down the street or up, going up the hill. I can walk on a good road by myself. I went up to the airport several times all alone. But outside of that, I seem to can't go straight. I turn to the left or right a little bit, and they have to correct me all the time. I'm used to walking with someone holding on to my arm or my hand. She was said, I can't walk straight by myself. I'm so crooked.
Well, who usually walks with you?
There are some kids, like Al McCarty or Claire's kids, Joy. Any one of her daughters, they lead me around town or go to the store or post office.
What's it like when you go into Fairbanks?
I never was around the streets there. She was, I can't stand around the streets very long for all the cars and everything going by. I didn't be right inside the truck, car. When I ever going for medical attention, I stayed at the hospital once, and once I stayed at Caris North. Gee whiz, did I come away from this baddie as the rest of them.
What's it like at Carriage North?
Oh, it gets on your nerves. People howling all night, especially the old woman. Once I was there in the daytime, the lightning out there in the summer, and there was lightning, thunder, and it hit the power plant or something, and the lights all went out, and people were in there. I don't hear them coming in their wheelchairs. All of a sudden, they said, I think the end of the world is coming now. They say, well, I said, let them come. We can't stop it. some old man or old woman would start crying, or all night long I hear, while I'm laying there awake, somebody groaning or something. See, was it just getting on my nerves? When I got out of there, gee, was I was acting crazy, or I wasn't myself anyway.
So how did you leave there?
Well, I left there when my whatever I went to Fairbanks for was over. I stayed there 7 days and seven and eight days both times. But I didn't want to go back to Caris North now. I had told my daughter at 10 now, or one of my daughters, to make appointment at, what you call them? Pioneer's Home. I know a lot of people there. They would get along better than I would at Caris North. But they wouldn't send me up there. They'd rather take care of me.
What's the difference between the two places?
Which place? Or the Pioneers?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's more quieter there. From what I've seen, I was there once. When I was blind, I don't think I'd have any trouble getting admitted there, because I worked with the Pioneers. I've done favors for them down here at Ruby. I don't think I'd have any trouble. They're taking anybody nowadays. Full Athabascans, and that's why I think I wouldn't have any trouble getting admitted in the Pioneer's Home. Because I don't know how they do it, but my agent, Social Security, will take care of me as far as board and things is concerned. And this year, what you call bonus, doesn't take care of me.
Well, after you got blind, did you start doing some things different and start, did you figure out some way to be able to do things even though you couldn't see?
Yeah, the only thing I can do and do pretty good is sawing wood. I just stand in one place and have a pile of wood right close by within reach. I could saw a lot of wood. That's about all I have done. I can't do nothing where I have to go some distance. I can never find the place where I started from.
You use a Swede saw to saw that wood?
Yeah. I don't use no change. I haven't used a chainsaw in my life. Well, they just come out by the time I went blind anyway. Everything came.
You split that wood then?
I split some of it. I can't split them fine, but I split them for a heater stove. Split them in half or quarter them. I use a wedge and a machine hammer to split through my wood.
You ever do that around here?
Yes. I done a lot of that sawing. I went with my family up the river and we built rafts. We gathered wood along the beach and we had our winter's wood. Patty remembers that time. Billy and I don't think, I think Morris too, but I'm not sure. I show them how to build a raft, how to make sweepers, so that we can, if a guest kicker boat goes on the bum with us, we wouldn't be stuck.
So how do you build that?
Oh, with logs. We pin them with auger. Or drill the holes with auger, and we use dry poles for the pins, and to build a sweeper or chair, build it different. I pin holes for the two holes for the pins and nail a board across to get them steady. And when I lay the wood on there, I pile the wood against each side of it, so it's pretty firm. When you roll, nothing shakes loose. The long paddles. We'll go across the river, any place.
How big are those rafts?
Oh, you make them according to how much wood you got cut. I've made some rafts. They were 80 feet long. I pinned two logs together. That was a 10 or Morlock Creek, they call it, 30 miles above there. I went up for, it was 1923. I went up to Morlock and me and two Roberts. Robert Pretty Albert, his name was, and Robert Alexander. They both went up with me. We was getting Joe Ansett's birchwood. And there was 40 cords. We brought it all down in one raft. But we had lots of trouble. We didn't have no power. We went up in a poling boat. We pulled up to that place and we built a slide, a chute down the hill. It was cut on the hillside.
What did that chute look like?
Well, this is made out of green. We cut the green poles and bark, peeled them, and we made a chute down to the river edge. And the wood pile was a long ways from the river. Oh, about 150 feet or 200 feet or yards it was. I don't remember, it's quite a while ago. We had to carry a bucket of water up the hill once in a while to wet the chute. It would dry up in the sun. But we got the 40 cords anyway. We built an 80-foot raft, and we had to, we just used this pulling boat. We didn't have no engine those days. And we got to the mission. I was going to tie up to another raft, which was high and dry on the beach. And it started dragging that raft in the shore, and I had to let go of it. And it eventually, Johnny, a fellow named, he was the mail carrier up there, he had a fish wheel put near up to the mission. It went against that fish wheel and smashed it to the beach. And he never said nothing about it. I went to work on the steamboat that next morning. I got on the Seattle number 3 and it was going down the river. Well, I went up to the mission house and I phoned down to Austin Joe and said, "You better be ready, there's a raft coming with your gas boats." One of them was on the raft, two of us was tying up the raft on another raft, which was high and dry, but they just started pulling that raft into the river, even as much as I paid out on the rope. I never tied anything like moving objects like that to tie it permanently. I have to let it slack a little at a time until we get at the end of the rope, and then we have to let go. And Austin Joe, he went to work. He got his nephew and camel and 3-4 boats. They finally stopped the raft way below the tower house. Well, that's all we had to do with that raft. After it was tied up, there's no more we could do. We're supposed to unload the raft, but see, we went on a steamboat. And Pretty Albert, Robert Pretty Albert. We made a trip down to St. Michael's. Just the summer, we went on strike at St. Michael. We went on the first strike there. Fred Tracy, the first mate, he'd come into the place where we all slept, and we had our baggage all ready to go any second. Suitcases, sacks, some of them had gun sack or some anything that would hold the stuff, our clothes. And we were all sitting, 17 of us, and they made me head of their strike leader. I told Fred, come on up, come on out, and all you boys stand by for covering up the barges. Well, we seen the freight that is coming up to Yukon. There was four big barges loaded. And we said, we're on the strike. She says, strike for what? For $5 a day and $1 an hour overtime. That's what we struck for. We were getting $3 a day. But this happened to be the last freight going up the Yukon, and four barge loads, big barges too. So he said, you won't get it. Well, right then I said to the 17 deckhands, let's go. Nothing to wait for. We were strung out on dock and we put our belongings in the NC warehouse at St. Michael's, and the rest of us scattered out, some to one village and the rest to another village, and some of us was playing pool. And while I was playing pool, I see Fred Racy coming. He come to me, he said, gather up your crew, we'll go back to work. I said, are we sure we're going to get $5 a day and $1 an hour overtime? He said, we'll have to pay it. They couldn't get no Eskimos this last trip. The Eskimos wouldn't get caught up here on the Yukon, too far away from their homes. So we went back. Inside of 5 or 10 minutes, I had the whole crew back there, and we all marched down to the boat. And I told Fred Racy and the captain, are you sure we're going to receive the $5 a day and $1 an hour overtime? And they both verified it. Then we started to work again. We were going to go to Unalakleet and come over to Portage to the Yukon. Walking. Not one of those 17 deckhands is alive now, I think. Maybe one fellow or so from Caltech.
Who's that?
There's Native boys.
What was that guy from Caltech?
Oh, Eugene. Eugene Medrose, I think. He's a pretty old man now.
When you guys were trying to get together on that, was there anybody that said they'd rather just keep working instead of going on strike?
No, they all agreed to strike, to go on a strike, and until we get we demanded.
You mean like the officers and stuff? Mm-hmm. How much were those mates making?
Mates? Oh, I don't know. I don't know what they're receiving a month or a week or everything. Everybody was paid by the month. We deckhands got paid every month. So the rest of the crew on the steamboats, I guess.
How much were other deckhands making?
We all got $2.50 to $3 a day and our keep.
Is that all the boats on the river?
Yeah.
What year was that?
Oh, that's so long ago. Right up to recently, when I went blind. Oh, gee, was that about 30 years? That was in 23 to 27 or 28, the year I got married. I worked on boats for 4 or 5 summers.
How was that work?
That was good, nice work, but gee, not enough paid. But you must remember that everything was cheap those days. And we worked cheap. We could buy a sack of flour for $4. Right now, it costs about $100 for 100 pounds. Everything in general was cheap.
Well, when you guys went on strike and you raised that wage to $5?
Yeah.
Did the other boats raise it up too then?
No, this boat that we're especially working on, those days the boats quit navigating. Just two or three boats that all worked from St. Michael's up to Yukon. There was before my time, before I worked on a steamboat. I believe there was about 600-700 steamboats on the Yukon.
Well, after that, did they raise the wages of everybody? All the deckhands on the other boats too?
No, there was no other boat. There's just this one boat was coming up the Yukon. We were working on that and we struck for higher pay. That didn't make any matter with any other boat. Just this boat that we were working on, we struck.
What were the working conditions like?
Oh, it was pretty good. They fed good. But we realized there was a whole lot of freight coming up Yukon as far as Ruby, or right here. From here up, we went on the strike again. Oh no, we struck right below Holy Cross at the wood pile. We refused to work or to anything there. And at Ruby, they unloaded two of those barges right here. I remember that, well, those business people, all in dressed in suit of clothes, they were longshoring with us. And there was no deckhands left, just three of us, along with an Eskimo boy that I took along. I picked him up at St. Michael's. Maxie Puff, he's dead now. He drowned a number of years ago, and I told him, he told me that he lost all his family, his uncles, his mother and father, sister and brothers. They died in the flu. in the 1918 flu. I could tell you some more of that later on. That year the flu epidemic was on. It was bad. That there's been flus every spring around here, but along the Yukon. But that big flu where it killed about 900 Eskimos in 1918. I had the flu too. I never got the flu since then.
So what was that like?
What the?
The flu that time.
Oh, I didn't feel no pain. I was hurting there, and I was, came home, and it took me a long time to walk the 3 miles. 3 or 4 miles it was that I was coming off the hills. I noticed that I was resting. Every once in a while I'd sit down on a nigger head and rest. And I had no ambition in me at all. Not even ambition to get up and walk. And for several times there I was going to sleep. I said, "Get up, Bill. Don't fall here out in the tundra anywhere. Get up and go." I kept saying to myself. Each time I got up, I walked a little farther, but I got tired. Until I made it to the summer camp. I was alone herding that time. There was a fellow named Peter Demoski and a fellow named Slim Dick was herding with me, but they got quarantined at Unalakleet, and I was 12 miles above there, herding all alone. But at the tent, I tied the dog up, my herding dog, and I just barely made it to my sleeping bag. Our sleeping bag was made out of deer hide with the fur inside. I just got into that sleeping bag and I dozed off. I dropped off to sleep, and I was that way for about 2 weeks. 10 days to 2 weeks. When I got up, gee, I was pretty dirty and sweat. I start look around the table for something to eat. Gee, I saw some milk. I tried to punch a hole in that, and I couldn't even punch a hole in it with a nail. I was that weak. And the Eskimos on above me, they were the whole village was cleaned out. And I remember, of course, I walked. The village was about half a mile from where we were camping for the summer. And there's a river right there, a Garwick, they call it. I heard the dogs were loose. They were eating on dead bodies. I saw people sitting at their doorsteps, they were dead. And babies crying. Gee, I had to go over to save some of the children, but it was all I could do. I was weak. I'd swim across the river and get a boat. That's what. It's a small river, same as Mulrosy River. You've been up Mulrosy?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was big, put near that big. The women and men, boys and men, they all died. Some of them hanging. Geez, it was awful to see. Some of them, actually, they saw their fellow men and boys dying right off. So they hung themselves on this here babies, they call it. Seal made from seal skins. They hung themselves up, two boys, pretty big boys too. They were hanging down from the ceiling. The Unit Fleet was quarantined and I couldn't get in that town. Then guards, they had that of the village, they were pretty strict. They saw me coming and they all come out in a body. Some with picks, spears or some, and clubs. I laughed at some people for years. They went after me, that whole body of men coming after one little lone person with all that stuff, clubs and everything, knives. They told me to go back. Well, I went back as far as 5 Mile Cabin, and I gave them a note for groceries. That was before I got the flu. It was before or after, no. Before, I think.
They were just trying to keep everybody out of Unalakleet?
Yeah, they kept everybody. They even left the mails 5 miles out of town each way. Down that trail to St. Michael's and the trail to Nome and the trail over to Portage. They left the mail out 5 miles. And they fumigated the mail or something after the flu was lifted.
So people in Unalakleet never got the flu?
Not one. But 12 miles away there was up towards Nome. I don't know about St. Michael's.
What was the name of that village?
Agavik.
How long did you stay there when you went there that time?
Where?
When you got over the flu and you went to that village?
No, I went up there before I got the flu, I think.
So you went there before you got the flu?
Yeah.
How long did you stay there?
I didn't stay in town. They met me out on the tundra. That's when I said they had all kinds of weapons for me.
I mean going the other way to Agavik. When you went to that village where everybody had the flu?
Oh, yeah. it's come on afterwards.
So from 5 Mile Cabin, where did you go?
No, not 5 Mile Cabin, that's Eagle Creek.
From 5?
No, it's Eagle Creek.
Yeah, but it's before you got food, so from there, where did you go?
Yeah, they tell me there was 900 Eskimos died. I don't know, up towards Point Barrow, I think that's the whole way, length of the coast, for St. Michael's and all included.
So let's see. Let me try to figure this out again. You were herding those reindeer, and then you went to Unalakleet, but they told you you couldn't go in there.
Yeah.
So then you went over to Agavik.
Yeah, I went back to camp.
Back to camp.
Yeah, and I was herding deer, and in one of those trips, soon afterwards, I got the flu.
And then after you got the flu, then you went to Agavik? Or it was before?
No,
you...
this was after I got, so I could walk up there.
Mm, okay, now we got it.
I couldn't do nothing for the babies. I heard kids crying in some of the houses, and people dying out, dead outdoors. I couldn't do nothing. And dogs was loose, and the dogs wouldn't allow me in the village. And as weak as I was,
so where did you go after that?
After I got well?
No, after you left Agavik. You went back to camp?
Yeah.
You had groceries there?
Yes, I had groceries. The people of Unalakleet brought me everything I asked for by the Lapps. The Lapps took my list, and he went to the store, and he sent by the guards whole sled load of groceries. And them sleds weren't very big.
Do you remember that Laplander's name?
Yes, real well. He's dead now, I think, him and his wife. But he's got sons. He's got one son that I know of living there between Nome and Unalakleet right now. His name was Clemison.
Clemison?
Yeah.
What was his first name?
Clement.
Oh, Clement Clemison?
Mm-hmm.
And his son there now?
Well, this son's name is Clement Clemison, and he has the same name. He's Junior or something.
Oh.
The old man, there was a bunch of Laplanders at Unalakleet. I know them all. Bears. There's a Peter Balls. Bango. Boynu. They're all dead now, I imagine.
Well, let's see, there's just one thing about that I'm trying to figure out now. You said you swam across that river?
No.
The Agavik River?
Yeah, I put two logs together to go across on, but gee, I couldn't enter the village. The dogs wouldn't allow me.
So you got a boat to go back across then?
Yeah.
know what happened that day. Did anybody survive?
So after all those people died in Igavik, did they go back there? Is there anybody living there now?
I believe there was some. Right now, I don't know if there's people living there, but there was one or two Eskimos that didn't die. I think they were. The village was abandoned after that. They moved up to Shaktulik, or on the way. Shaktulik was is mouth another river. Only they were inland. Right now, they moved out to the seacoast, I understand.
Well, when you were leaving Unalakleet, or no, when you're leaving St. Michael's on the boat after you guys had that strike, did the mates give you a hard time for being the leader of the strike?
No, he didn't. He didn't have that grudge against me. He really didn't believe in grudge or anything. In fact he treated me better. As I was the only one in the whole bunch of deckhands that knew how to steamboat and do all the work, and I was quick and fast. And the rest of the people, they dumb, and most of them had no education at all.